after Ash Wednesday, I was at a primary school parents' meeting, and I got talking to a woman there. Sorry if any of you have heard all my stories before, but this woman was part of the CFA, and she told me the following story. During the Ash Wednesday fires, they were out there and they were with another truck, and they got caught, and they were going to be burned over. And they had a good truck with a sprinkler on the back, so they all got set up, and the other truck was an old truck that didn't have any equipment, so all the crew from that jumped onto their truck. And there was one guy left who didn't have anywhere to fit in. So they opened the cab door and said, jump in. And he ended up lying on their laps with his head on the lap of this woman who was on the far end. And he was looking up into her face as the fire descended on them and all hell broke loose. And he said to her, well, if we're going to die, I might as well introduce myself. My name's Rob. And she said, oh, my name's Mary. How do you do? And then, of course, all hell breaks loose. And she said this was just the most incredible moment of her life. Now, you would think it'd be a nice romantic movie, wouldn't it? But in actual fact, she said, I've never spoken to him again after that moment. We occasionally see each other at big CFA gatherings, because he was from another brigade somewhere else. And we see each other across the room and we sort of make this momentary eye contact, but neither of us know what to say. And she said, I realised in that moment the only thing that's important are people. But my husband and I have been working two jobs, buying second cars and speed boats and saving up for a holiday house. And I realised none of that's important. But he doesn't get it. He's still on the old track. And then she said, we're just going like this. See, what's happened is that the trauma has completely changed her sense of priorities, and he hasn't. And actually we find that no two people go through the same trauma, because the trauma is, what do I think is going to happen to me, and what does it mean to me? What does it trigger off? Now, my discussions with people here is that a number of people had very traumatic events. On the first time I came up here, I spoke to a guy who was, sleeping as the fire came up. And I think the CFA came and banged on his door and woke him up, and he jumped on the truck and they rescued him. He said, otherwise I'd be dead. His house burned down. Now, you know, that's a very... how do you make sense of that? Well, we have to over time. And I think that becomes very important for people who've had this sort of experience to actually recognise that something important has happened, and they will have to actually work out what's important about life now. So that's going to be partly about how do we establish the priorities and make a plan to express that. I said to this woman, can't you talk to your husband about, you know, what you've been through and help him understand and maybe, you know, work out what are your priorities now? She said, no, I couldn't talk to him. He's far too anxious. If he knew my life had been in danger, he'd never let me go back to the CFA again. And it's the most important thing in my life. So she wasn't going to tell him. So this actually is going to put a stress on the relationship, isn't it? It probably will take some time for that stress to really threaten the marriage, but it will eventually if they're going in different directions, won't it? And so I think it's very important now, what are we, 4 months, 3 months down the track? This is the time where people are probably starting to come out of the running around chasing your tail, trying to get everything sorted, into the sort of more long term. And this will be a time when for some people the trauma will start to surface, because a lot of people will just shut it down and just go on with the urgent things. It's a very common thing. Shut down grief too. Actually, I've been working with a family who had a very tragic loss of one of their, you know, teenage boys in a car accident. Very tragic circumstances. And they had a teenage, his little sister. She was absolutely devastated. But she was in the process of changing schools and heading into year 10, 11, 12, and she really has got, you know, strong motivations to learn and so on, but she wanted to make her position in this new school, new friends. She'd just started doing it. And so she wouldn't engage with any of the family grief or anything. She didn't want to go to the memorial services now she's, I said to parents, it's really important for her to re-establish the structure of her life, and she'll deal with this when she's ready, possibly when she moves beyond school. She's gone to uni. And true enough, 3 years now, and she's started uni, and I saw her on Monday, and she said, I really need, you know, to work this through. And she's going to work it through now. But in fact, what she's done is she's held her life together. She's gone for the structure. Now, if we can, you know, we're used to thinking of trauma as disabling people. It doesn't necessarily. People are able to put it aside and go for it, but probably only to a certain extent. And I think the earlier people start dealing with it, the better. And that means really being able to stop and talk, reflect, share it with whomever you can that will understand it. And go from what happened to me to what did I think was going to happen? What did I think was going to happen in the worst moments? If that's too dangerous, the thought is not in words. Because when we're in that extreme state of stress, we know now from what goes on in the brain that the arousal state is so high that it activates the most primitive parts of our brain, the reptile brain. And reptiles don't speak English, so there's no language there. It's just an absolute sense of what I have to do now to survive, if I can do anything. And often what actually happens is that some kind of change will take place where the person will just emotionally disengage from some things that don't seem so important and hang on to what is important. And when they come out the other end, they often can't find the words to actually explain what's happened, but they feel it. I'm just not interested in that, and I'm really going to go for that. And this is where we often need a conversation to talk about it, to recognise what happened. And if we do that, we start to open up the possibility of kind of building a new picture. Now, it's probable that, you know, maybe even most people didn't have a trauma. But I reckon it's really important to be sensitive to, if you're talking to people and they talk about being very threatened, very scared, very much in danger, I think what's often helpful is to ask the question, when you thought that the worst was going to happen, what went through your mind? What did you think? What did you decide? And that would be a basis for conversation. You don't try and fix it for them or help them. Just provide that listening ear that will share it with them and get it into words and starting to talk. Because we know the problem is that as part of the whole stress psychology, if you like, is that when we're in stress, we're focused on the problems. That's a good thing, isn't it? Focused on the problems because we're going to deal with it. But in fact, when we're focused on the problems, we can ignore the benefits, the values, the things that are available to help us. So in a trauma situation, you'll find time and again, people, when they tell their story, will actually tell the story up to the moment of greatest danger, and then they'll stop. And they'll move from the description of the story to the emotions they have about it. And you don't know what happened. I had an example of doing some training with people today, and somebody gave this description of a situation where he was dealing with very difficult clients and he thought he was going to be assaulted. And he gave this description where confrontation happened and the person made the angry gesture, and he said, I thought he was going to deck me, And then he goes off into, we shouldn't have to deal with these kind of clients, he shouldn't be here in this agency, blah, 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 blah. And so what he's set up now is a loop where anything that reminds him will send him back into this emotional state, which will go around the track of blame and the organisational factors as to why it should have happened, and it'll go around that way. Whereas what we have to do is we have to listen for that disruption. I call it the ad break. You know, on TV when you have an ad break at the most exciting part? Because you'll stay and watch the ads, won't you? Because you want to know what happened. Well, they always disrupt their stories at the most exciting part. Well, the most dangerous part, the most awful part. What we really need to do is not go down that track of we shouldn't have these clients here, what's the agency doing, our managers are incompetent, nobody cares about us. Don't worry about that. Just simply say what actually happened. And you'll find two things will have happened, one of two things. The guy wasn't really going to deck him, he was only threatening him. Or he had the skills to recognise what's happening and say something very relevant that actually de-escalated it. In either case, he's shut himself off from what prevented what he was scared of from happening. So every time he remembers it, he just goes up to the greatest danger and then round in his emotional loop, instead of actually saying, I was really scared but he wasn't really going to hit me, or I was really scared but I must have the skills to manage myself quite well with these dangerous clients, you see? Because in fact we know that as soon as the brain has got adrenaline in it, it becomes biased for negative information, for threatening information, for danger, at the expense of reassuring information. It's been shown in experiments time and again. Did you ever nearly tread on a snake? Do you notice how you react when you see any crooked sticks in the environment for quite a while afterwards? See, that's the bias in favour of threatening information. There's something long and crooked, it must be a snake, I'm going to jump. That's the way the brain works. And it keeps us safe, you see. The people back in the last ice age had said, no, we've had one snake already, I'm sure that'll be enough. Probably got bitten and killed, didn't they? Or got eaten by saber-toothed tigers. So you see, this is part of our psychology, that we exaggerate the problems under stress. And this means we actually always need help to get a perspective. We need to get outside our own head to get things into perspective. We need to get outside our own head to put the trauma experience together in its proper form. So we're talking about trauma, we're talking about there will be people in the community who only have the dangerous fragments of their experience and are looping emotions from them, and we'll have people that are maybe not quite so traumatised but more in the stress, pessimism, negative thinking, can't see my way out of it. And what really helps is to have a place where you can talk with people who will just listen and ask you questions to help you find the more positive side of things. So I think that's going to be a factor for communities, you know, probably just starting around about now as you head into those long, dreary, dark winter days as things get cold and so on. That can be quite a hard time. We find that if you look at the statistics of when people put their hands up for some kind of support or help or counselling, there's often a big blip initially and then it fades right away, and then about 6 months you get another blip and then it fades away, and then around the anniversary, because you won't be uncomfortable with the hot windy north wind, you know, I'm pretty uncomfortable in Yarra Glen still, you know, so it goes on like that. And it even happens for events that are not seasonal. The same curve is there for the counselling service for New York after the September 11. The stats go down like this, and then up for 6 months, and down, and up for 12 months, and down, and up for 18 months. Now, when I've I noticed that in Ash Wednesday, we've noticed in many other things. I reckon it works like this, that most of the people affected by a disaster are ordinary healthy people. They're not our usual mental health clients. They're people who are not using the system. They've got various strengths and capacities. They've managed their lives, most of them. So healthy people can put aside a certain amount of bad experience for a certain period of time. But as you keep pushing and getting stressed and more stressed, it uses up a lot of the energy. And it takes away the energy you need to immobilise the disturbing experience or to keep on top of the underlying feelings of pessimism and whatever else from this more negative bias. And after about 6 months, people start getting very tired, and then they can't keep on top of it. And what will often happen is one of two things. Either traumatic experience will start to break through and people can suddenly have nightmares, or they will begin to get sudden fluctuations in their mood, sudden feelings of real pessimism and despair and exhaustion and I can't face it all, or episodes of high anxiety and things like that. This becomes very disturbing. Actually, I think it's about fatigue, and often when people take time out, maybe take a break, get away from the area, do some recreation, have some fun. You can possibly manage it when you're feeling bad, but do something and then recharge, and then people feel I can actually tackle it a bit again.